Let me ask you some questions about these common features in these stories, the significance of the forbidden fruit.
Well, there's this standard folk tale motif called the one forbidden thing. Remember in Bluebeard, don't open that closet, you know? And then one always does it. And in the Old Testament story, God gives the one forbidden thing. And he knows very well, now I'm interpreting God. he knows very well that man's going to eat the forbidden fruit. But it's by doing that that man becomes the initiator of his own life. Life really begins with that.
I also find in some of these early stories the human tendency to find someone to blame. Let me read Genesis 1, then I'll ask you to read one from the Vasari legend.
Right.
Genesis 1, and God said, have you eaten from the tree which I commanded you that you should not eat? Then the man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. And the Lord God said to the woman, what is this you've done? And the woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. I mean, you talk about buck passing, it starts very early.
That's right.
And then there's the Vasari legend.
It's been tough on serpents, too. One day, snake said, we too should eat these fruits. Why must we go hungry? Antelope said, but we don't know anything about this fruit. Then man and his wife took some of the fruit and ate it. Unumbate came down from the sky and asked, who ate the fruit? They answered, we did. Unumbate asked, who told you that you could eat that fruit? They replied, snake did. It's the same
poor
story.
Snake.
It's the same story.
What do you make of this? That in all of these stories, the principal actors are pointing to someone else as the initiator of the fall.
Yeah, but it turns out to be snake. And snake in both of these stories is the symbol of life throwing off the past and continuing to live.
Why?
The power of life, because the snake sheds its skin, just as the moon sheds its shadow. The snake in most cultures is positive. Even the most poisonous thing in India, the cobra, is a sacred animal. And the serpent, the Naga, the serpent king, Nagaraja, is the next thing to the Buddha. Because the serpent represents the power of life in the field of time to throw off death. And the Buddha represents the power of life in the field of eternity, to be eternally alive. Now, I saw a fantastic thing of a Burmese priestess, a snake priestess, who had to bring rain to her people by calling a king cobra from his den and kissing him three times on the nose. There was the cobra, the giver of life, the giver of rain, which is of life, as a divine, positive, not negative figure.
The Christian story has turned it around because the serpent was the seducer.
Well, but what that amounts to is a refusal to affirm life. Life is evil in this view. Every natural impulse is sinful unless you've been baptized or circumcised in this tradition that we've inherited, for heaven's sakes.
By having been the tempter, women have paid a great price because in mythology, some of this mythology, they are the ones who led to the downfall.
Of course they did. I mean, they represent life. Man doesn't enter life except by woman. And so it is woman who brings us into the world of polarities and a pair of opposites and suffering and all. But I think it's a really childish attitude to say no to life with all its pain, you know? To say this is something that should not have been. Schopenhauer, in one of his marvelous chapters, I think it's in The World's Will and Idea, says life is something that should not have been. It is, in its very essence and character, a terrible thing to consider, this business of living by killing and eating. I mean, it's in sin in terms of all ethical judgments all the time.
As Zorba says, you know, trouble? Life is trouble.
That's it.
Only death is no trouble.
And when people say to me, you know, do you have optimism about the world, you know, how terrible it is? I said, yes, just say, it's great. Just the way it is.
But doesn't that lead to a rather passive attitude in the face of evil in the face of
wrong? You participate in it. Whatever you do is evil for somebody.
But explain that for the audience. I mean, you say yes to that which you...
Well, when I was in India, there was a man whose name was Sri Krishna Menon, and his mystical name was Atmananda, and he was in Trivandrum, and I went to Trivandrum. And I had the wonderful privilege of sitting face to face with him, as I'm sitting here with you. And the first thing he said to me is, "Do you have a question?" And because the teacher there always answers questions, he doesn't tell you what anything, he answers. And I said, "Yes, I have a question." I said, "Since in Hindu thinking, all the universe is divine, is a manifestation of divinity itself, how could we say no to anything in the world? How could we say no to brutality, to stupidity, to vulgarity, to thoughtlessness?" And he said, "For you and me, you must say yes." Well, I learned from my friends who were students of his that that happened to have been the first question he asked his guru, and we had a wonderful talk for about an hour there on this theme of the affirmation of the world. And it confirmed me in a feeling I had had that, who are we to judge? And it seems to me that this is one of the great teachings of Jesus.
Well, I see now what you mean in one respect. In some classic Christian doctrine, the world is to be despised. Life is to be redeemed in the hereafter. It is heaven where our rewards come. And if you affirm that which you deplore, as you say, you're affirming the world, which is our eternity of the moment.
That's what I would say. Eternity isn't some later time. Eternity isn't a long time. Eternity has nothing to do with time. Eternity is that dimension of here and now, which thinking in time cuts out.
This is it.
This is it.
This is my...
If you don't get it here, you won't get it anywhere. And the experience of eternity right here and now is the function of life.